Welcome to Real Vision. It's Wednesday, December 23rd, 2020. This is Real Vision Daily Briefing, live without a net. Welcome, Ed.
Yes, thanks, Ash. It is good to talk to you. And my understanding is, actually, this is the last time you and I were going to be talking on the Real Vision Daily Briefing for the year.
Yeah, hard to believe.
Yeah, so I understand that we are going on a hiatus between Christmas Eve and New Year's Day, except under the proviso that markets stay with us, because, you know, we know how it is when markets move and we're not doing the daily briefing. People wonder where the heck are we? You and I, we will, you know, come from under our tree, our Christmas tree, if necessary, and do this all again if markets move in a major way.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We're going to be here. We're being mindful of the, I think it was December 2018, Christmas Eve massacre in markets. We're going to be here in case anything bad happens. We'll jump in from wherever it takes.
Exactly. So tell me, Ash, so what's on your mind today as we close out the year?
Well, you know, we were talking a little bit about Tesla, which has obviously been a story that's gotten a lot of buzz, not just on inside in the wonky financial press, but more broadly. People are talking about this stock. And there was a chart that I saw that really I thought was quite striking. This is the Tesla chart that we were talking about earlier. I know we're live switching. I think you can see this on your screen. Basically, what you see here on the left is the $615 billion market capitalization of Tesla that shows the revenue at the bottom. The revenue number is $0.3 trillion. That's about $30 billion when you do the dimensional analysis. And on the right, you have the seven largest auto companies next to it, all of which have a total market capitalization of $587 billion. Now, this is a really striking chart when you look at this. Effectively, Tesla now worth more than all of the other auto companies combined. Just to pick out a name at random, if you look at General Motors, GM right now in 2019 did $137 billion in revenue. On the net income line, they did about $6.5 billion in 2019. These are order of magnitude differences, order of magnitude or orders of magnitude differences in price to earnings ratio. This is a big shift. This is the most risk-on chart that I can think of, a highly simplified, highly stylized example that shows you just where markets are at today.
Yeah, I think this is a good jumping off point before we get into anything pandemic related or employment related, because I have a whole litany of things to talk about related to this. The first and foremost is I actually tweeted out this chart because it comes from an Axios article. And I think the Axios article was titled something like "The Divide Between Tesla's Sky High Value and Reality Mirrors the Broader Economy." And they're talking about the K-shaped recovery. And so when I tweeted this, I had a response from Aaron Task, and he was telling me that actually, you know, Elon Musk is trying to revolutionize the entire grid, not just the auto industry. So he looked at this as not an apples to apples comparison, misleading. And, you know, I responded to him on Twitter, not in a disbelieving way, but saying, a positive example of this actually is a company that outgrew its industry. That's the online bookstore industry, and that's Amazon. Yeah. Because, you know, even though right now you can consider Tesla an auto and an auto supply chain company, they're in the auto supply chain and autos, and you could, you know, get all the auto supply chain companies in there as well if you wanted to. But the reality is that Task is saying it's bigger, and Amazon also became bigger. And so I've been thinking about this Amazon thing for a long time now.
Yeah.
Since 2018, I've been saying that, you know, Tesla's basically an option, a lottery ticket, in the same way that Amazon was circa 1999. And that's how I'm thinking about Tesla first and foremost. We can go on and talk about that in a little bit, but that's sort of the main hub of what I want to talk about.
Yeah, you know, some great points. I was actually reading your analysis from 2018. Interesting points you made. Aaron Task, a very smart guy. And look, he could be absolutely right about this. You and I could be sitting down in December of 2040 when we have a lot more gray hair than we even do now, having this conversation and talking about how Tesla basically could have, you know, massively it's brought into the future a whole series of different industries, battery technology, motor technology, the infrastructure around automotive recharging stations. There are all of these things that Tesla could absolutely revolutionize. There's no question about it. But the reality here is you're talking about risk when you see that gap between price and earnings. And look, when we talk about Amazon, that could be precisely the right example. Look, Elon Musk could end up being a combination of Thomas Edison and Steve Jobs in building this company. And there are a lot of very smart people, Aaron Task included, and others, who think that that's a possibility. But the reality is, when you just look at Amazon, you're talking about the potential for significant survivorship bias. You're picking the one case where it did, in fact, work. And, you know, there are a lot of other cases where it didn't. And so that's something to bear in mind. It's about risk. It's about the revenue and earnings getting ahead of the price. It could catch up. It could more than catch up. There was a period there in the early 2000s where I think Amazon was down for like 3.5 years. You lost money on that stock if you'd bought at the peak. So again, over long time horizons, lots of things that can happen.
Yeah, 100%. And so, you know, I have a whole, as I was saying, litany of stuff to talk about that backs into that. Let me just preface it with this statement that this is the first time right now that I really felt that we are definitely, I felt really the most like we're in sort of a 1999 phase. And I was looking back through history into previous manias that are in the recent past. And the two that are in the recent past are, you know, the late 90s and also the late 60s, early 70s. And I'm a student of history. And interestingly, let me show you, I have this book called Ling. It's about the founder of Ling Temco Vought, which was one of the companies of the late 60s conglomerate phase that people were really into. And I'll get into that later on when I talk about that particular stock market event. But when we go back to the 90s, and the reason I feel like the 90s is going back and thinking about Tesla and Amazon, it bears in mind thinking about the trajectory that Amazon went through. And I was there, and I remember you were there, you remember as well. So there was a guy who was a convertible bond analyst at Lehman Brothers called Ravi Surya. He wrote this report saying that Amazon was going to run out of money, and he was worried about their ability to generate cash before their convertible bonds were due. They had issued these convertible bonds. And on the back of that, there were jitters about Amazon. Amazon actually sold in February of 2000 these convertible bonds, $672 million at 6.9% interest rate. And that was right when people were having jitters about the bubble and so forth. And they got, you know, the terms that they got were flexible conversion term. 6.9 was a really high rate for a convert at that particular time. I think they got that like 2% in their previous convert. And literally, you know, 2 months later, the door slammed shut on the market. And interestingly, Brad Stone, who wrote a 2013 opus about Amazon called The Everything Store, he said that if Amazon had not raised that money for that convertible at that time, they would have gone bankrupt. Mm. They almost certainly would have faced insolvency had they not. So that one convertible was very important. And here is Ravi Surya in the summer after that convertible was done, saying that Amazon could still go bankrupt. And I saw an article in Fortune magazine from June of 2001, just preparing for this daily briefing, saying that Amazon had lost some 90% of its value by June of 2001 compared to when Surya first started saying that Amazon could go bankrupt. So 90% down, and we also know that had they not done that convert, Amazon would have gone bust. So even the great Amazon, which rose from the ashes like a phoenix, went through its hard times and potentially could have gone bust as well.
That's just a fascinating story, Ed. That's great. I love hearing these stories because, as we always say, history doesn't repeat itself. It does often rhyme, and you can start to hear some of the rhyme scheme sounding really similar. I mean, a couple of points to what you just said that I think are really incredibly relevant here. The first is, if you had sold Amazon stock in 2001 or 2002 or 2003, you lost money if you bought at or near the peak. Second, such a fascinating story. I know you and I both have fixed income backgrounds, but you think about that, the ability to raise money just before, as you say, the door slams shut. And it almost is like this butterfly effect, right? If they hadn't been able to do the issuance, if there was one pension fund that wasn't willing to take the debt and the bank that was doing the fundraising couldn't do it. I mean, there's just so many things that could have happened that could have gone wrong that didn't. And now when we look back on it, we impose this sense of retrospective inevitability. This is the sort of the flip side of survivorship bias. We know now that Amazon is a company that's revolutionized the world. You could imagine the same thing happening with Tesla, and it could be on the bubble. It could be in either direction, right? The inability to do that key funding round at exactly the moment where you need the cash, exactly the moment where you're going to get locked out of markets, the public debt markets, if you're not able to do it. And then on the flip side, if you do it, you look back and you go, oh wow, that was a great deal. But of course, the management of the company were brilliant, and they were going to find a way to make it happen. Only works when it does.
Exactly. And, you know, I have two sets of, or actually you could even say three sets of companies to make a comparison to. First and foremost, let's talk about companies that did go bust. Mm-hmm. Webvan, we're talking about Cosmos, another company. That's one that, you know, was supposed to, you wanted to buy something really quick, they could deliver to you, you know, zip, zip, zip like that to your door. Those are three separate companies that were big. They were big flameouts. They went bust. They could have been the next Amazon. Interestingly, in every single one of those cases, we have companies today that do the exact same thing and are flourishing doing it. Webvan, we have Fresh Direct, we have Blue Apron, you have even Instacart, which doesn't own the groceries, but actually just goes and picks up the groceries for you. Amazon Direct, Amazon itself is doing what Webvan did. Amazon is also doing what Cosmo did and delivering same day right to you through their Amazon Prime service. And then finally, Pets.com, in this pandemic, we have everyone getting a pet. I actually got a dog during the pandemic. I go to Chewy.com. Chewy.com is doing gangbusters during this particular phase. So there, right there, we have three different companies whose business model was actually proven, but they didn't have the wherewithal, they didn't have the capital structure to be able to make it through that particular period. So when I think of Tesla today, in 2018, I actually thought of Tesla more in the Amazon mode of they're doing a convert. Because if you remember, Tesla had these converts that were potentially going to go, that were going to convert, and they needed the money. But they got through that period, and now they're on the other side of that period. They've gone up a ridiculous amount since that time. And so as a result, I think that they're more in the survivor game. And the question is how do they survive after the fact? This is the second number of companies that I would compare Amazon to. I would say, look at AOL, look at Yahoo, and look at companies like that. Because you could be Yahoo, you could be AOL, or you could be Amazon and survive. All three of those companies survived, but one survived in a great way. The other two did not survive in a great way.
Well, that's so right, Ed. And it's such a fascinating analysis and way to think about it. For many years, Pets.com was used as a joke about everything that had gone wrong with the valuations in the 90s and with the business models in the 1990s. And now, as you say, everything old is new again. We're revisiting it. Chewy, a big website. The joke was that, there was never a business model to be made delivering 40-pound bags of cat litter when you could just go into the corner bodega or your local supermarket and buy one. But again, that reverses out. I remember back in those days, Cosmo, and there was another one called Urban Fetch.
Right.
Remember Urban Fetch?
Yes.
I was working at Credit Suisse at the time. I was in Midtown Manhattan, and you know, we used to order like Hershey's bars, Snickers bars, just to see if they would deliver it. You know, a 69-cent item, and they would. And you know, we kind of had a sense that maybe this was a little bit that the business model there wouldn't quite work because they had no minimums. You could literally order a Twix bar, and they'd come and drop it off to you within 60 minutes. It was just completely absurd, fun, but completely absurd. But the reality is that business model has matured. As the supply chains have matured, as the systems that are between them have matured, as the delivery models have matured. So you could say, in a way, that, and I'm sure if you go to a bar in Menlo Park or Palo Alto, the guys who founded those companies are sitting around saying, damn it, we were right. We had the right model. We were just too early. The reality is that it's thinking about things on multiple time horizons, talking about survivorship bias, talking about the peers in the company, why one company survives and another fails, trying to figure all of these things out. History is a great guide to this. And again, coming back to that point, just to shift gears here a little bit, talking about where the markets are right now. I mean, if you want to talk about where this market is, if you want to talk about risk on, look at the Russell 2000 chart right now. So you look at the Russell 2000 chart over 2 years, it's a moonshot. I'm not a technical analyst, but it's pretty clear that the Russell 2000 right now is at about 2000. The 200-day moving average, a very long-term moving average, is at 1526. So we're 25% or thereabouts above the 200-day moving average. By every reasonable technical indicator, this is way overbought.
Yeah, definitely way overbought. And I would say that you know, we're getting to the point now where it's not just the Teslas of the world, but it's across the board that we're seeing companies that are getting to levels, not necessarily an absolute level, but on a relative basis that is worrying. I think one thing to remember is a lot of people are thinking about Cosmo and Pets.com and Webvan. They forget about AOL and Yahoo. And even if they do remember AOL and Yahoo, they don't remember, that Amazon went down 90%. Qualcomm, which is a great company right now, they went up 2,600% in the year 1999. And then you had other companies like Cisco, Juniper doing incredibly well. You had the frauds like WorldCom that went out of business. But, there was a whole ecosystem that was out there in 1999 that people were forgetting about. And as you say, it's about the survivorship bias.
Yeah.
One thing that I'd like to point out too that is interesting, that just gives you a sense of where we are today versus where we were then. If you look at what I would call today's Nifty 50, or part of today's Nifty 50, none of those companies except for Amazon actually, in its current guise, existed in the internet bubble. Okay, so Facebook didn't exist as a company at all. Amazon was the only darling that went up and down during that period. Apple, although it did go up and down, it wasn't the same company it is today. It didn't have the iPhone. It's a completely different organization, in my view.
Didn't have services revenue.
Right. Netflix.
No cloud.
It went public, and it wasn't public at that time. It was formed in 1997. And then finally, Google was formed in 1998. It also wasn't public.
Yeah.
So it's a completely different world. We just have to remember that this is the case today.
Yeah, so true. And Netflix, not only was it a private company, but Netflix wasn't a streaming company. They'd send you DVDs in little envelopes in the mail, which seemed incredibly innovative at the time.
So, that makes me think a little bit about the Nifty 50 and the last bubble. Because, when you and I were talking, when we were in the previous bubble, there were people from the bubble before that who were warning us, this is overbought. It can't go on. You have no idea what you're doing. This is terrible. These valuations, they cannot continue. Interestingly, I was probably, 3, 4, 5 years old at the time when this was all going on. You can go back and look at the late 60s or early 70s. We had the conglomerates, Ling, Timko, Vought. That's the, this is the book of the founder, Ling, who I read about. ITT Corporation, Litton Industries, Teledyne, Textron. The trick back then was to look for acquisition targets with solid earnings, that had lower price earnings ratios, put them up into your conglomerate, and then milk that thing. 1968, things peaked out. There was a nasty bear market in 1968 to 1970. The S&P fell 36%. And then when it was all over, people said, okay, we've been chastened. Now we're going to go after the blue chips, what I would call the FANG stocks. Mm-hmm. Back then, they were the Nifty 50. These were stocks like Polaroid, Xerox, McDonald's, Coca-Cola, IBM, JCPenney. Some of them you remember because they're in the news today.
Yeah.
The average price earnings ratio of the Nifty 50 was 42 times, whereas the average PE ratio everywhere else was 19 times. Is that not what's going on with the stay-at-home stocks? It's exactly the same sort of thing. People have said, okay, we're shifting. This is where we want to be. And then, of course, the bottom fell out. All of the main stock indices in the future G7 went down between September and December of 1974. They bottomed, having lost at least 34% in value, 43% in real terms. And here's the kicker. You know that the secular bull market started by 1982. West Germany didn't recover in real terms to the level after that bust until 1985. Mm-hmm. The UK didn't recover until 1987, and the US didn't recover from its 1974 crash until the year 1993.
Extraordinary.
So I think that, you know, I don't want to, you know, make a huge case that we're going to see the same thing again, but history does rhyme. And I think that we should consider the concept that things are getting overbought.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PI, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Yeah. You know, I'm reminded of the great F. Scott Fitzgerald quote from The Crap Gup, his sort of journal of his descent into madness. And the quote is, "The test of a first-rate intelligence is the ability to hold two opposed ideas in the mind at the same time and still retain the ability to function." And that, in many ways, is what these markets seem to be asking investors to do. We know the cautionary tales and we know the success stories. We know the excesses in terms of valuation and we know where the value lies. We know the business models that don't make sense. And at the same time, we see this great American innovation engine creating phenomenal companies like Amazon. And understanding and Netflix and Apple and all of the FANG stocks, Google. And we try and sort through where we are in the cycle. We try and understand where the valuations are. In trying to figure this out, we bring it back full circle to Tesla. It's a really complicated question.
Yeah, it is, especially now that we're administering this vaccine. 2.6 million people have already gotten the vaccine. We can see light at the end of the tunnel. That's a good segue into the economy because, you know, light at the end of the tunnel, if you look at commodity prices like copper as an example, copper is way up over the last several months. During the reopening, it really went up a lot. On the back of that, countries that have real, you know, access to copper, like Peru, are very much in vogue. A lot of people haven't been watching this because they're looking at equities. But interestingly, you know, the search for yield, the risk on trade is so large that Peru was actually, they issued $4 billion of debt at the end of November, including a century bond. This is a, you know, an emerging market. And this 100-year bond which expires in 2021, had a yield to maturity of 3.23%. So that's Peru. So you're getting Peru for 100 years at 3.23%. That gives you a sense of the fact that it's not just in equities, it's also in bonds. That's where we're seeing this reflation trade. And then the question now becomes for you, Ash, what are the numbers you're looking at in the real economy and in the pandemic right now?
Well, you know, exactly right. And those are the key questions. I saw an interview with Dr. Fauci earlier in the day. So, Dr. Fauci is saying about 1 million doses have been dispensed here in the United States alone. And we need 75 to 80% saturation with this vaccine before you start to get something that looks like a herd immunity that starts to provide an umbrella immunity effect for the country. We've got about 1 million dispensed here in the U.S., as I said, and that gives you, give or take, 75 to 80%. It brings you about 250 million doses, 250 million doses that would have to be dispensed. We're not there yet. Dr. Fauci says that broadening in terms of the logistics of how this is going to go out, that broadening the base of the inoculation is probably going to happen sometime in April, if all goes to plan, meaning if you're not a high-risk person, you're not a police officer, you're not a healthcare worker, you can just go down to your doctor and say, hey, I want the vaccine. He's saying that looks like April, probably by the end of summer, in his estimation, when we start to be able to go out and do things again. So maybe by the time we get to Labor Day weekend, we can go out and have you come up to New York City and we can bring the whole team out for cocktails at a bar here in New York. But that's a long way away. And so you talk about the light at the end of the tunnel. I guess the question that I think about is just how long that tunnel is. And that's really a key question. If we bring up the COVID hospitalization chart, what you can see here is, once again, every day making new highs. I think we're at 117,000 right now, current hospitalizations around COVID. And that, of course, is about 7,000 above your ceiling number of 110,000, I think the number was that you said a couple of weeks ago that you were looking at for the key number. And I'm curious to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, so I was thinking that, you know, just to understand where the trajectory was, by mid-December, we were going to get to 110,000. If we got above that, then that would be a sign that, you know, more people were being hospitalized, and therefore we're going to see an accelerated pace of economic rollbacks compared to what I was thinking. And yeah, we pretty much bang on hit the levels that I was looking at. And so I do think that we're going to continue to see rollbacks in the U.S. and also in Europe. Interestingly, I'm less concerned about the U.S. in terms of the near-term rollbacks. If you look at the numbers, both in terms of the case counts and the death counts, they're going up at a lower rate, which suggests that we're starting to peak. That is, before we get this next wave as a result of Christmas and New Year's. So that's good for now. But Europe, where we look at what's going on in the UK and Germany in terms of their lockdowns, you know, tier four lockdown almost all across Germany, they're saying as a Boxing Day. And then in Germany, we've got a total lockdown as well because light didn't work. They had, you know, almost 800 people who died in the last day, which is, you know, if you gross that up, that's levels that are similar to the United States. And Germany was supposed to be a positive actor in the first time. Yeah. So that's telling you that there are major economies in Western Europe and also in the United States, if you think about California, that are getting crushed. And so to me, that says when you talk about light at the end of the tunnel, we definitely need some serious offsets from government to deal with that because, yeah, we're going to have at least a month or two more of pain of that gross amount.
Yeah, absolutely. All about the second derivative. And that's why your analysis is so interesting on this and why I always find it so compelling. And my screen is burning up with questions coming to us live from the audience. I'm afraid we're not going to be able to get through them all, but we have pages and pages of questions. And I'd like to just jump in and get started. This one's to both of us. Any comments, but I think really to you, any comments about David Rosenberg's recent statement that nothing prevents the creation of more BTC beyond 21 million? Oh, that maybe.
Oh, yeah, I think that is.
I thought that was going to be a macro question when I saw David's name. We're burning up the charts. I think it's an interesting idea. I don't really see it as being terribly feasible, to be honest with you. 21 million is in the cultural DNA of Bitcoin. I guess you could say that it's not really Bitcoin if there are more than 21 million coins. And maybe maybe there's another hard fork. But I have a very hard time believing that the core of the community is going to tolerate an inflation rate beyond what's been stated in the original white paper. So, all right, here's one that really is to both of us. Any fears about the Trump bill veto and evictions, Ed?
Yeah. So I think, where the rubber hits the road in terms of, how long is that tunnel before we get to the other side is in these kinds of things. So I was looking at the politics today. So we've got the stimulus bill. The stimulus bill has been passed. It's almost $1 trillion. But there's a lot of pork in that. Trump is not happy about it. And he's also not happy about $600 instead of $2,000. Going to families or going to individuals, 4,000 for families, he says. So he might actually veto that. He has actually vetoed the defense bill,
right?
Because of Section 230 of the Communications Act and the Confederate generals part of it. And so I think there is some danger from a political perspective going forward. And of course, obviously, just thinking about Europe, there's also the danger in terms of Brexit and this new virus, which is creating some sort of difficulties with regard to, goods going to and from the UK.
Yeah, that's exactly right. This virus mutation is something that we really don't have our heads around, we collectively, from a scientific perspective. You know, just to pick up and add some color on that point, because I think it's really strange times here, politically speaking. Section 230, by the way, of the Comms Act is Trump is upset about the inability or insufficiency of stripping away protections from the big tech giants around communications freedom and some of those issues. It's more of the same on a similar fight. But one of the things that I find really so interesting about this, and I was looking at this right before we got on the air, is that we are currently here in December 23rd, 2020, at a point where Congresswoman AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, is tweeting out very favorable things to Donald Trump. She's very pleased. She's very glad that he wants to expand that number, saying that she's happy to work with him, that Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib is happy to work with him. These are strange political bedfellows here on this. And at the same time, a couple of days ago, we have Pat Robertson, the very well-known televangelist here in the United States, very conservative, longtime supporter of the president, saying that President Trump is out of touch with reality. Effectively, he is erratic, and that he's living in an alternate reality. Very, very strange political times.
The way I would characterize it, the danger, other than just from an economic perspective, but from a political perspective, if you're a Republican, is a split potentially in the party. Yeah. And this is especially true, obviously, for the January 5th senatorial election in Georgia. But basically what Trump is saying is that you guys aren't down for the people. I'm down for the people now, that I don't have to worry about electoral politics. I'm going to, speak my mind. And, at the end, I'm going to make the vetoes. When he's out of office, that's going to mean that a large swath of people are going to be very upset with where Mitch McConnell and the like are headed. And so, for the Republicans, they have to understand what that means for them. And no one knows what that means for them.
Yeah, that's very well said, Ed. That gets to the point, which is that what we're seeing is left-leaning populism and right-leaning populism landing on the same basic policy positions, sort of against center-left and center-right traditional establishment positions. That's a very unusual place for American politics to be.
Interestingly, I saw Michelle Malkin, who is a right-wing pundit. She was retweeting Tulsi Gabbard, who still is a representative in Congress for Hawaii. She's a Democrat who ran for president. She didn't vote for this bill. She voted against it, and she was explaining why, and the defense bill. And Michelle Malkin was saying kudos to her. And if you read some of the comments there, all the people saying, Tulsi, you know, we don't like this and that about her, but, you know, she's principled, et cetera. I think that you're right. There is this sort of populism on both sides where there's shared interest there, and it's not clear where that's going to go after January the 20th, 2020.
Yeah, that's so
2021.
Right. Yeah, it's. I think that's exactly right. And it really is a strange thing to see shake out, where you have left and right populists uniting against establishment of both parties. A really interesting and very hard to read, ultimately, political landscape as we think about going forward. You know, Ed, as I look through these questions, I realize how overweight cryptocurrency is in some of these things. Obviously, it's what people are talking about. There's a lot of motion here. We don't want to get lost in that, but I want to take at least one more of these questions. And I should say, as preface before we jump in here, that we've actually just announced two new podcasts here at Real Vision. The first is Between Two Chains, kind of an institutional analytic look at the cryptocurrency markets and thoughts around how institutional investors are positioning themselves in the space, and a great deal more. And then Ground Floor Consensus, which is my new podcast, where we do in-depth conversations with people who are the biggest names in the space, the most insightful thinkers in the space. And what we try to do is, and this is something that I'm really passionate about, because people in the crypto space increasingly feel like we're talking to each other, and everyone else is kind of getting left behind, not really understanding what this increasingly wonky conversation is about. I'm really intent on trying to broaden the base and bring the ideas that are really cutting edge in the crypto space to a much broader audience, because I think there's just a lot of smart people out there who really need to join this conversation. Oh boy, this first question coming up to us from Brandon is not an easy one. It's XRP. Any thoughts on the SEC lawsuit? This, of course, is in reference to Ripple. This is a really interesting story for people who are in the cryptocurrency world. I mean, the short answer is too soon to tell. This was something that just came out in the last few days. The lawsuit, I don't even believe, has been filed yet. They've pre-announced it. Obviously, they got word of it. It's an interesting question because if you're familiar with this space, Ripple XRP is a company that is really interested in doing a lot of the back end plumbing work on Wall Street, transferring money, currencies, that sort of thing between as an interbank intermediary between financial institutions. This is really tricky because the regulatory legal compliance play is so strong in Ripple's message and in their model. They're basically saying, hey, listen, we understand this space. We understand how regulated institutions work. If SEC ultimately declares that Ripple is a security, that throws a massive wrench into their plans. Excuse me. It's going to be very tricky. Also, the word is that SEC is going to be filing suit against Mr. Garlinghouse and Mr. Larson, two senior executives of the company, personally, which seems to say that these guys are really playing hardball, and this is something that could be a very intense debate.
Yeah, I mean, for me as an outsider to the community, the way that I'm looking at it, to be honest with you, is the whole thing about securities law. That is... if a fiat currency issuer like the United States wants to stop any sort of cryptocurrencies from gaining traction, that's the first port of call to say, you know what, this is not a currency. Cryptocurrency, you call it a currency, but we look at it as a taxable transaction. Every transaction you make, when the currency goes up, you now owe Uncle Sam or, you know, the revenue agency in the UK money. Fork it over, your 100% profit, you need to give us 35% of that or 38% of that, whatever it might be. To me, that is the power of government, and this is a power that they're now showing with Ripple.
We're so early in the regulatory legal compliance cycle of this. I mean, one of the interesting things to me, and I just had this conversation actually with Nick Carter, who's an incredibly bright thinker on all of these issues, that if you look at just regulatory treatment within the United States, only within the United States, there's this really broad divergence of the way Bitcoin, for example, gets treated by different regulatory agencies. IRS treats it like property. CFTC treats it like a commodity. And then there's the question of whether or not these protocols are a security. This comes up, obviously, very specifically with XRP and SEC, because that's their relevant regulatory agency, if it is in fact deemed to be a security. These are really complicated questions, and we're still incredibly early in the cycle. Now, people who are great, the most passionate advocates of Bitcoin will say you can never shut Bitcoin down. And that's true. If as long as there's an internet that is running, you're able to conduct these transactions on a peer-to-peer basis. So the ability to actually sanction it or to stop it is very limited. Governments all across the world have this challenge. But the reality is institutions don't play in spaces where there are significant regulatory risks. And if the regulators really wanted to play hardball over Bitcoin or any other cryptocurrency, they could absolutely decimate that price. And if the price gets whacked, and if there is significant regulatory barriers that institutions don't want to play in that space, you could see Bitcoin not being eliminated. Again, it can never really be blocked, but you could see it truly decimated. I don't think that's going to happen. I think we have very sort of wise, thoughtful people here in the United States on the institutional side and the regulatory infrastructure of this country. And I think we're going to figure out a way to move forward because there's just so much promise in this technology as a store of value, as a medium of exchange, for smart contracts, which is Ethereum, EOS, some of the other newer protocols. I really think that we're at the beginning of a renaissance in this technology. I think we're in like the third inning, maybe at latest. But there is risk, certainly. And also, I believe, and Raoul has spoken to this point very eloquently, I think that what we are going to see is an integration with the broader macroeconomic infrastructure that we have in this country and around the world. We're going to see an integration more broadly with financial institutions, and we're going to see it come under the blanket of the regulatory compliance infrastructure that we have now in place. It's hard for me to see it happening any other way. I know there are people who are very involved in the libertarian side, people who are really passionate about the freedom that this technology provides. I think ultimately what we're going to see is greater regulation and it being brought more broadly into the fold.
And that can only be positive. I mean, as I was saying to you earlier, I think it was yesterday, PayPal was sending me a message saying that, you know, we're going to allow you to go between fiat and Bitcoin for free until the end of the year. They're obviously making a play to say, look, you know, we're a trusted financial institution. We're part of the financial architecture. You're one of our customers. We want to get into this space. Get into the space with us because, you know, you trust us. You have an existing relationship with us. That's good. So I think that that's a good play. The real question is, for me, is, you know, the dynamics of the mania in other parts of the world moving into Bitcoin in a way that causes Bitcoin to attract attention that regulators want to put a kibosh on. Let me tell you how I'm thinking about this. Bitcoin 50,000, Bitcoin 100,000, those are levels that guaranteed the SEC will not like. And when I say not like, what I mean is that they're thinking of it in terms of the way that they're thinking of XRP right now, ways that will cause them to get into the space in a way that's negative for the space and for regulation. So in some ways, you know, you almost don't want it to go up in a parabolic way.
Yeah, you know, and in some senses, the Ripple story is the one that's getting the most buzz. But FinCEN actually weighed in a few days ago on self-hosted wallets. This really speaks directly to the ability of people to autonomously control their own transactions in the Bitcoin space. And this is something that I think they gave 15 days of guidance on. Coinbase has pushed back and said, hey, guys, this is like we need more than 2 weeks. The holidays are coming up. We need a full 30-day period. This is a really significant structural question about the way that this industry is going to function. My guess is self-hosted wallets continue. I suspect that to be true. But again, you never know in the short term from a regulatory perspective where things are going to go. And to your point about PayPal, PayPal has 305 million users in 202 different markets. So, you know, we often forget. My mother's husband was just asking me. He said, well, you know, Bitcoin's really interesting. How the hell do I buy this? Right. This is something that there are still a lot of people who are interested in the space, who want to purchase these assets, who don't really know how to do it. And PayPal, precisely as you point out, Ed, provides an on-ramp to that ecosystem.
So you, I'm sure you have tons of other questions for us. And, you know, by the way, in terms of David Rosenberg, if I had an answer to what he, where he's going, I think he's talking about derivatives, basically. Think of it in terms of the mortgage-backed securities market, that there wasn't enough supply to deal with what people wanted, and so they created synthetic supply. I was in the GKO market in the late 90s. That's the domestic Russian bond market. And, you know, because it wasn't a convertible currency, there were limitations in terms of flows. People created synthetic GKOs. And those, of course, to a degree blew up when you had the default. But you can see that people will find a way to transact. They will find a way to increase the supply, if it's, even if it's a synthetic way. That's what financial innovation is all about.
Yeah, we should use the maybe the air quotes around innovation in that context. Often these things blow up. I mean, when I hear the words synthetic GKOs, I think about the bonfire of the vanities, right? That this is really, this was some wacky stuff. I'm going to try and just skim through these questions here to try and avoid picking one more crypto question. Although we love it, we like to talk about macro on Real Vision Classic and talk more about crypto on Real Vision Crypto. By the way, if you're not a Real Vision Crypto subscriber, you can sign up for free right now, get all of the content, not a trial, full content for free right now available on the Real Vision Crypto website. Realvision.com will get you there. So, Ed, let me just take an amalgamation of a few questions, because it's really the question that I most want to ask you. If people have hit on this in different ways, but really, as we come into 2021, Ed, what's your big picture outlook? What's the thesis, and what are you going to be watching to see if that thesis comes to fold?
Yeah, I think you probably put it the best in terms of the light at the end of the tunnel. The if you had to pick one question to ask, the question is how long is that tunnel? Yeah. And then if you wanted to drill down in terms of that question, the answer, the next question is, what happens to the companies in America and in the world during that period of time? In various sectors of the economy, in terms of their balance sheets, you know, ones that are less leveraged and more leveraged, and then what happens to consumers during that period of time. I think that you showed me a chart earlier that we might be able to even put up on the screen, you know, that's the percent job losses in post-World War II recessions. I think that that's really telling just from a just from the person perspective, you know, from the household perspective. What you see in that chart is, you know, going across the x-axis is time from the beginning of the recession, from the beginning of the job losses. And then, you know, on the y-axis, if I'm getting this wrong, but, you know, it could be x and y in the opposite direction, is the percent loss of jobs. And so the, you know, first thing to note is every single recession is very similar, except for the 2007 recession and the 2020 recession. Those are orders of magnitude different. The 2007 recession was different in terms of its depth and length. You know, it had the same trajectory as all the other recessions, but it was just longer and deeper in terms of the employment factor. This recession is a completely different animal again. It's orders of magnitude worse in terms of its depth. But even today, after the so-called V-shaped recovery, you see that we're not even close to any of the other places. The closest we can get is the trough of the 2007 employment recession. And Ash, we were looking at this chart right before we came on, and I was telling you, if you look at the line of this chart, right around, I would say, the 9.5% mark, which is, by the way, much lower down than the -6.2% mark from the trough of the 2007 employment recession, the line starts to kink. You know, it's straight down, then it comes straight up, somewhat V-like, and then right around 9.5%, it starts to roll over. The slope of the line changes. So, to me, that's the biggest question. This is the biggest question, not just in terms of the tunnel, but after the tunnel, and also in terms of politics. If this line rolls over, if that slope continues to move in a way that it doesn't cross over the 2007 employment recession line, you're going to have hell to pay economically and politically.
Absolutely. And I think that's exactly right, that the best that we can hope for right now is approaching the trough of what those of us who were covering in 2008 remember to be a horrific, horrific recession. So that is a really powerful point, and it's a powerful chart, because sometimes we get lost a little bit in the day-to-day, the second derivatives of unemployment claims, of initial claims, of continuing claims, and we lose track of just how far below par we really are. And looking at all of those other years on the top, 1948, you know, all of these charts going back to 1948, it's pretty striking to see just how low we are. In fact, Ed, it would be great at some point in the new year, it would be great to do a Real Vision Daily Briefing about exactly that topic. I'd love to explore that with you and to hear your thoughts and your analysis on where we are in labor markets. I think that would be something that would be really important for us to think about, because that really is the big picture issue here, macroeconomically and, as you say, politically. This is a prime example of the political economy. I mean, you know, it's just a striking chart. And with that said, we're probably running long here, as we always tend to do on these live shows. I guess I was going to say it's probably good news if people don't see us until January 4th.
Yeah, you know, actually, it's good that you mentioned January 4th, because my understanding is we're going to do some funky new things. And that is we're going to have more sort of outside people on starting the new year. I think that we're, you know, I have an analysis that I put together that's going to go up on January the 1st about what we're thinking about in terms of the new year. But then we're also going to have some analyses from other people, Lynn Alden. We're going to have Mike Green. I already spoke to Darius Dale. That's going to go up. And I want those same people to talk about the here and now, not just their, you know, their long-term look on the Real Vision Daily Briefing. So we'll take those same people who are going to be on the Real Vision platform behind the paywall and put them on the Real Vision Daily Briefing as well in a different format. So I think that'll be good. Less of me and more of them.
Yeah, that's great. And we're going to just continue to do all of those innovations here. And we're excited. I think we have a lot of other things up our sleeves that maybe we're not talking about publicly yet. But I hope that 2021 is going to be the biggest and best year ever for Real Vision.
Yeah, I'm hoping it's big and great for us, and that it's great for the economy and, you know, healthcare outcomes and all of our listeners and viewers.
Yeah. And if we see you under the tree tomorrow on Real Vision Daily Briefing, we know that's a bad sign.
Exactly. And, you know, just to give you a sense of how bad things are in general for 2020, just right now, you know, I keep checking my phone over here because my wife's upstairs. We the heat went out. Our boiler broke. We have no heat. It may seem like everything's nice and cozy here right now, but literally it's like 60 degrees in here. So I'm waiting for the guy to come and fix our heat so that we have heat for Christmas. So that is in a nutshell what 2020 has been all about.
Oh man, I really hope on January 4th when we come back that you're going to be in a heated room.
Yes, I hope so too.
You know, like an Oliver Twist version of Real Vision Daily Briefing, where you're over a barrel fire or something.
Right.
Thank you, everyone. Hopefully, markets will remain stable here for the next couple of days, and we'll see you in January. So if we do not, everyone, please have a happy holiday, and thank you again for joining us.
Yeah, it was great talking to you, Ash. Thanks again, everyone.
Great talking to you, as always, Ed. Thank you.